This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 146, Dating in the Family. Last time, we revisited Mauryan India to discuss international relations between the Seleucids and their eastern neighbors after the Seleucid-Mauryan War. Today, it's time to discuss the royal family of Antiochus I Soter. And almost 150 episodes into this, you probably know what that means. Unlike the Persians who ruled before them, the Seleucids never really developed the same institutional importance for the role of Queen Mother. Part of this is a result of the Greek and Macedonian cultural tradition which birthed the dynasty. As a rule, women held much less direct social and economic power in the West than they did in Iran. And when women did accrue the sort of power and influence we've seen from Persian queens, they were derided and cast as borderline evil, scheming temptresses and witches in popular writing. The most famous example of this in recent episodes was Olympias, the mother of Alexander the Great. But it's a topic that came up repeatedly in Greek descriptions of Achaemenid royal women. That said, part of the diminished role of Queen Mother under the Seleucids is simply that they didn't have one in these early formative years of their empire. Seleucus Nicator's mother had already died back in Macedon by the time he rose to power, and Antiochus Soter's own mother, Apame, died a few years before he took the throne. So there simply wasn't anybody playing that role in the early Seleucid years. Of course, Seleucus's second wife, Stratonike, was still around, but, Antiochus married his stepmother, who, to be fair, was much closer to his own age, and might have been having an affair with her stepson before it was made official anyway. Stratonike is still around at our current point in the narrative, the late 260s BC, and she will actually outlive her second husband by a few years. Unfortunately for our purposes, we do not know much about Stratonike's activities during Antiochus's reign. She just doesn't seem to have been all that involved in the politics of the time. Instead, she appears to have spent a lot of time in Babylonia, in the would-be capital of Seleucia on the Tigris, where Stratonike was involved in local business ventures and sponsored temple festivities. She also received a level of near deification. The Babylonians translated her name as Astarte Niku, reframing her Greek roots as an homage to the local goddess Astarte, and frequently calling the queen by titles otherwise reserved for goddesses. We just don't have a lot of context for why they did this, beyond her general involvement with temple affairs. For all we know, it may have been as simple as not wanting Stratonike to be outdone by her own daughter, from her first marriage to Seleucus. Without harping too much on how exactly everyone was related here, King Antiochus arranged for his younger sister and stepdaughter, Phila, to marry Antigonus Gonatas, the king of Macedon. Apparently, their union was just as strong as the early Seleucid marriages, because Gonatas didn't follow in his ancestors' footsteps as a polygamous Macedonian king, only ever marrying Phila. Following the Cremonidean War, when Antigonus Gonatas broke Ptolemy II's naval power in the Aegean, Phila played an important role in expanding Antigonid influence out to the Greek islands. Both she and Stratonike were important patrons of the Temple of Apollo on Delos, and Phila, in particular, was given authority over a temple precinct on Samos after the Ptolemies were evicted. Based on epithets used to describe Phila on that island, she may have been honored as semi-divine herself. To round out this messy generation, we have Antiochus's brother, Achaeus, sometimes called Achaeus the Elder to distinguish him from his grandson. I've referenced this elder prince a few times in recent episodes because he was the preeminent Seleucid leader in Anatolia, overseeing the construction of several new cities and personally ruling over a few of them himself in the inland villages of the peninsula. Though he is never referenced with a specific title, Achaeus was the de facto viceroy and governor of the Anatolian provinces, fulfilling a similar role to Cyrus the Younger as Carinos. Under Achaeus and Antiochus, much of Anatolia came into a system similar to the patronage system of Rome, with important local leaders sponsoring or supporting smaller stakeholders in exchange for support of their own. Achaeus also makes for a convenient lead-in to the next generation of the Seleucid family. Unfortunately, we do not know anything about Achaeus's wife or wives, but their children became very prominent in the Hellenistic world. The one we need to worry about least right now is Andromachus, simply because he was one of Achaeus's younger children and has not done anything of note at our current point in the narrative. Achaeus's eldest son, or at least the eldest one we are sure existed, was Alexander, who had already risen to prominence during his father's lifetime as another important leader in Anatolian politics. A royal decree inscribed in the Carian city of Bargulia mentions that Alexander, the son of Achaeus, was left in charge by Antiochus I after the First Syrian War. The implication is that Alexander was the governor or commanding general on the front line of the disputed border with Ptolemy in southern Anatolia. When Achaeus died, not long after his elder brother the king, Alexander largely stepped into Achaeus's role as the most important Seleucid in Anatolia, and the man in charge of land grants and overseeing other local rulers. Achaeus's daughter, named Antiochus, makes her one and only, albeit very important, appearance in recorded history shortly after the Pergamonian Revolt in 262 BC. Although Eumenes I of Pergamon was not a eunuch, and at least one reference to his son survives in an inscription, something had happened in the preceding years. By the time Pergamon seceded from the Seleucid Empire, Eumenes had no sons of his own, so he followed in his uncle's footsteps and adopted his own nephew, a young man named Attalus. Apparently, as part of the peace settlement following Eumenes' revolt, Attalus was married to Antiochus, making her the mother of the so-called Attalid dynasty in Hellenistic Pergamon. Then we come to the more complicated part of Achaeus' family. Far be it from me to accuse the Hellenistic royals of having a variety of names, but the usual line from historians is that Achaeus had two more daughters, both named Laodike. One was his eldest daughter, and the other was apparently the youngest child overall, since she married Antiochus I's grandson. I would like to propose an option that doesn't require Achaeus to recycle names while reproducing into his sunset years. Another Achaeus. It's the logical explanation. The younger Laodike is more plausibly a daughter of a second man named Achaeus, probably a son of the one we've been talking about. I have no documentary evidence for this, but it would frankly be weird for an important Hellenistic leader to not have a son named after himself, and inserting an extra generation here would smooth the timeline out in a way that makes more sense. That just leaves Achaeus' eldest daughter, Laodike I. Laodike was married off to reinforce Achaeus' relationship with his more powerful big brother, King Antiochus. Of course, she didn't marry the monogamous king, and for whichever reason, the royal brothers did not want to marry her to the heir to the throne, probably just because they were keeping that spot open for more advantageous arrangements. Instead, Laodike was married to Antiochus' second son, also Antiochus. However, I want to jump around a little bit before we get into young Prince Antiochus. First, let's talk about the current crop of Seleucid princesses, two women we've already met, Stratonike and Apame. Stratonike was the youngest of the bunch, and at this point is still pretty unimportant. After officially making peace with Antigonus Gonatas, Antiochus sealed their alliance by sending Stratonike over to Macedon for her wedding to the equally young Prince Demetrius, who was destined to become King Demetrius II Aetolicus when his father died. But that was still decades away at this point. For now, there's not much to say about the future Queen Stratonike of Macedon, but just keep her in the back of your head. Princess Apame, on the other hand, has already caused some trouble. She was sent off to Libya in a marriage alliance with the Ptolemaic rebel Magas, and arguably their union was the inciting incident of the First Syrian War. Like her sister, there's not much new to say about Queen Apame of Cyrenaica at the moment. However, she and her daughter with Magas, Berenike, would go on to spark a minor political upheaval in Libya and Egypt when Magas died in 250 BC. That will likely be a bonus episode in the near future. And yes, I know, but I do have a plan to get those out. Suffice to say, Berenike was betrothed to the future king Ptolemy III until Apame reneged on that deal, tried to marry a younger son of old Demetrius Polyocrates, who was then assassinated by Berenike. Then the princess briefly seized control of Libya for herself and eventually married Ptolemy III anyway. That brings me to Antiochus I's sons, and to the title of this episode. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. Stepmother shenanigans aside, Seleucid incest, to the degree that it happened at all by ancient standards, was pretty tame in comparison to the Achaemenids. Today's episode title is actually a reference to something else, a topic which comes up frequently because it is unsurprisingly important to history. Calendars and dates, as in the number of the year. For about 2,000 years at our current point in the narrative, monarchies have been using the number of years a given king ruled to keep track of the date. Even non-monarchies like Athens had a political office where the appointed politician in that role was used to designate a year. Seleucus backdated his reign when he recaptured Babylon to a few years earlier when he declared war on Antigonus Monophthalmos, but in general, he continued with the trend of dating documents according to his regnal year. Co-kingships were unusual but not unheard of in the late 4th century BC, and there was an established protocol for that too. You kept using the regnal year of the elder king. So April of 311 to March of 310 marked year one of Seleucus, and the victorious founder of the empire was assassinated in year 30 of Seleucus and Antiochus, since Antiochus I had been declared co-king. Under normal circumstances, March of 280 BCE would mark the beginning of year one of Antiochus by himself, starting the count over again. Instead, Antiochus ordered his scribes not to do this. They recorded the date as year 31 of Antiochus, continuing the count of years from the beginning of what historians call the Seleucid era, Western history's first widespread system of continuous annual counting. Of course, most calendar systems in use today follow a similar system, whether you're counting from a proposed birth date of Zoroaster or Jesus Christ or the ministry of the Prophet Muhammad. However, the Seleucid era was the first version of this to gain widespread adoption. It was so widespread, in fact, that Antigonus Gonatas also started using the Seleucid era, dating all years from 311 as year one. Though, since the Greek calendars usually started at the autumn equinox instead of spring, the Eastern and Western versions of this were never quite in sync. The fact that Macedon also adopted the Seleucid year is probably evidence of a wider trend that had already emerged before Antiochus took power, one which probably explains his unconventional choice to continue using his father's regnal year. Other people, usually on a more local level, had already been using a continuous count for some time, and the choice to adopt Seleucus Year One as a starting point was just a move to solidify their dynasty as the most important and bring everyone else's calendar into line with their own. According to Jewish tradition described in the Talmud, the Judeans started keeping a continuous count in year 6 of Alexander the Great. However, all of the documents archaeologists have found using that supposed Alexandrian system actually follow the Seleucid era. This has led some modern historians to reinterpret year 6 of Alexander as meaning Alexander the Fourth, the boy king, since his year 6 was the same as Seleucus year 1. Likewise, later Persian documents would also describe their dating system as counting from Alexander the Great, despite using a variation of the Seleucid era. This system of counting went on to be so ubiquitous that it became known as just the Greek year, as it continued to be used across much of the Greek world for many centuries after the Seleucid dynasty faded away. And it traveled even beyond that. A Syriac Aramaic inscription on a stela in China, dated to the Greek year 1092, has been found, meaning that the Seleucid era was in use by some communities for over 1,000 years. The other aspect of a continuous dating system is that it is very helpful when you need to distinguish between kings of the same name. Instead of having to use other context to decide if year 3 of Darius means Darius the 1st, 2nd, or 3rd, we can say with certainty that year 35 of Antiochus is definitely Antiochus the 1st, not the 2nd, 3rd, or all the way down to the 13th. That said, the early Seleucids also exist in a funny transition period. Unlike modern AD-CE dating, where the label applies to every year in the cycle, Antiochus I's scribes continued to specify who was king at the time. It would be like describing the current year as the year of our Lord 2025 in the reign of King Charles III, or something like that. You don't really need the king's name, but the fact that the Babylonians kept including it is helpful, because it reveals some political drama inside the royal family. When Ptolemy II invaded and began the First Syrian War, Antiochus declared his eldest son, Seleucus, co-king. So we suddenly start seeing Babylonian documents dated as year 38 of Antiochus and Seleucus. I put my discussion of the Seleucid era here, because without it and the Babylonian regnal dates, we might not even know Seleucus's name. The sole reference to him surviving in Western literature comes from Justin's epitome of Pompeius Trogus. As an epitome, Justin's work is already a summary of Trogus's. However, these events aren't even described in the body of Justin's text. Instead, they are merely referenced in the prologue to Book 26, effectively a bullet point list of events described in each of Trogus's main sections. How, in Syria, King Antiochus, surnamed Soter, died after killing one of his sons and naming the other one Antiochus king. That's it. That's all we get. The Babylonian documents give us little more information. Dating business records and official decrees from 274 to 266 as years under Antiochus and Seleucus, then shifting with year 46 of Antiochus the Great King and Antiochus his son. Without Justin's epitome, we would only be able to guess as to what happened here. And without the Babylonian documents, we'd only have a vague inkling that Antiochus I killed one of his sons. between the two, we get a much fuller picture. In or around 266, Seleucus, the eldest son and co-monarch of Antiochus Soter, committed treason. Perhaps he tried to assassinate or usurp his father. Maybe he had some sort of treacherous affair. If Antiochus wanted to give his son similar experience to his own, then Seleucus would have had command of the upper satrapies, like Bactria, famously a great staging ground for revolt. What we do know is that relatively late in his life, Antiochus I's succession plan was upended when he was left with no choice but to execute his designated heir, and he quickly called on his younger son, Antiochus II, to fill that role. That finally brings us to the new co-king, Antiochus II. We don't really know anything about him at this point. He was born around 286 and probably did not have much interaction with his father during his formative years, given that Antiochus Soter was thrust to the throne and rode off to fight civil wars, then continued in that vein for most of his reign. Presumably, young Antiochus was relocated to Antioch in Syria at some point, and became politically and militarily involved once he was old enough. Still, he was only 25 when Soter died, and just 20 when he became co-ruler. He did not have a lot of independent experience, to say the least. However, Antiochus and Laodike did have at least one child at this point, probably two, a boy named Seleucus and a daughter named Stratonike. By 261, Laodike may already have been pregnant with Antiochus II's younger son, of course, another Antiochus. That brings me back to Antiochus I, still our reigning king in 261 BCE. His reign is referenced in numerous Babylonian and later Greek, Roman, and medieval chronicles, which all agree more or less on the end date, with the only variation coming from inclusive or exclusive counting, or in the case of the Uruk Kings List, how good the scribe was at subtraction. The fact that the circumstances of his death are rarely referenced, and that he was a battle-worn 60-year-old man in the 3rd century BC, leads most historians to just shrug and suggest that Antiochus I succumbed to illness. The Roman author Aelian offers an alternative in his On the Nature of Animals, suggesting that Antiochus died in battle against the Galatians. This is possible. Perhaps Galatia rebelled or some independent raiders were still at large. Galatians were also often hired by all of the Hellenistic kingdoms as mercenaries, and the final years of Antiochus's reign were dotted with minor border skirmishes trying to claw territory back from Ptolemy. It's just unusual that the king himself would make an appearance in one of these minor spats. Maybe it was an ambush, maybe it didn't happen. All we can say is that Aelian referenced it because Antiochus's horse supposedly got revenge. As that story goes, when Antiochus was killed by a Gallic warrior, the horse reared up and trampled the attacker. Either way, in 261 BCE, the king died. He was Antiochus Soter, the savior of Anatolia against the Gallic threat. He was the great king, Basileus Megas, the mighty king, king of the world, king of Babylon, and king of all lands. At 62 years old, he had been the Seleucid king for 20 years, and with his death, Antiochus II became sole ruler of the empire. that is going to wait a few weeks. I'm sure there are people we could count as kings who haven't gotten the full reign, family, religion episode treatment, and I'm taking this as an opportunity to introduce an important religious concept that will be with us in the background for the next 800 years or so. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters' 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.